Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Corporations now are so powerful that they threaten both democracy and capitalism itself, says our guest, Robert A.G. Monks. He is a true capitalist insider. He's one of the world's foremost shareholder activists and author of Corpocracy. What's that? It's corporations and their interests taking over the political system, Mr. Monk says. He's put his wide experience in both business and politics to work challenging corpocracy and makes it plain that the antidotes are already in place. For starters, he says each of us must realize the United States government is so dominated by CEOs and business roundtable companies that they have replaced we the people in our most fundamental decisions as citizens. When we will kill and risk being killed.
I have three draft age grandchildren. And if we had a draft, and if our involvement in Iraq required a political consensus adequate to support a draft, would I be doing the same things I'm doing today about Iraq? I would not. I would be lying down on Pennsylvania Avenue, kicking and screaming. And I'm not doing any of that. Well, my diminished citizenship, of which I'm ashamed, probably is representative of other people. And in effect, this is one more thing that we've corporatized. We've corporatized the use of violence. It used to be you could only use violence when you got political consent to do it.
Robert A.G. Monks is a shareholder activist and a very successful lawyer and businessman. Mr. Monks has founded a number of investment funds and asset management companies. He started Institutional Shareholder Services, True Cost, an environmental research company, and The Corporate Library. He's served on the boards of a dozen publicly held companies, headed Boston Trust, and held several influential government positions in the Reagan administration. In addition to Corpocracy, Mr. Monks is the author of several other books as well. The biography written about Mr. Monks is called A Traitor to His Class. Bill Russell and I first sought out Mr. Monks in the 1990s, drawn by his work as a shareholder activist, and we brought him to you then. When we learned about Corpocracy, we were eager to again bring you what we knew would be an important conversation. Robert A.G. Monks, I had the privilege recently to be in the company of one of the people who is appropriately given credit for being a mastermind of strategy within the great Citizens' Revolution of the Civil Rights Movement. And as I was reading your Corpocracy, which is a very, very important book, I was thinking about what Bernard Lafayette told me, the Reverend Dr. Bernard Lafayette. He said, Paula, if you're going to do something that changes a large nation and addresses a really important fundamental problem, you have to start by getting the data. I sensed that that was a great part of what you were doing with Corpocracy, with your lawyer hat on, that you were giving me the data so that we could move in a very positive direction to reclaim democracy from its, what you call, evil twin, Corpocracy. Is that in the range?
What I was trying to do is to identify the current language with which we discuss issues of corporate power and political power in America today, and to try very carefully to suggest ways in which a legal vocabulary, an economic vocabulary, an ethical vocabulary are not really satisfactory in and of themselves to explain where we are. And you have to begin to try and see what actually is happening. And so out of this emerge sort of notions of the large corporation as a participant in political society. Well, that turns out to be the place you really have to begin, because for what, something over 100 years, the Supreme Court has said that corporations are persons, and in the last...
The Supreme Court didn't say it.
The Supreme Court, you're right. They continue to ratify the notes of the recorder. of the opinion in 1886.
A former railroad lobbyist.
Yes, a former railroad lobbyist indeed, and apparently he made some money out of it.
Big time.
I'm shocked.
But in recent times, in particularly the Bilotti case and the Buckley case, the applicability of the legal vocabulary is quite pervasive, because it ends up providing us with a society that has constitutionally guaranteed free speech rights in corporations. So there's no legal way really to restrict their involvement in our political life. This is the kind of example of, this is the getting the data. You have to know who the players are. You have to understand that everybody isn't in a nice, neat box, and that perhaps the informing language for a discussion of this kind is power. And a corporation is splendidly designed to permit the acquisition of wealth. And the way in which it does that is through the focus of power. And the existence in our society of artificial people with the kind of power that the largest corporations have quite clearly has fundamentally changed the polity. And I don't think that this is generally understood. So this is gathering the data.
The other part of the data piece, and you refer to it, I think you even cite Orwell, is the language piece. One of the real challenges in politics in general in this country, certainly now, but probably always, but certainly today, is that words have been, the meaning of words have been changed. Good becomes bad, red becomes green, red becomes an apple, and that language piece is very important in the in a variety of different ways. At the core of that, well, there are several, but I want to start where you start, which is the notion of economics and the economy.
Orwell would be George Orwell, who will be with us through much of the next hour. Yeah. We are talking specifically with Robert H. E. Monks, who has done a great service with his book Corpocracy. Be with us when we come back in just a moment. Robert A.G. Monks is our guest here on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was just talking about George Orwell, who you may remember wrote 1984, and a lot of what 1984 is about, Mr. Monks, is about this business of language. And then you carry forth quite beautifully with this, I guess you'd call it a neologism, corpocracy, as compared to democracy, demos being the people, and corp being corporation. This fusion, if you will, of democracy and its evil twin. I love it that you call it its evil twin, because there are moral and ethical as well as economic and political issues involved when you talk about corpocracy, right?
Indeed there are. And to linger on the language for a minute.
Please.
One of the things that's most difficult is that otherwise very intelligent people sit around and have discussions about how the political model really explains corporate power. And they borrow the vocabulary from the political model. So shareholders elect directors. Shareholders have never elected directors in the history of man. Directors are picked by the incumbents, and a slate is prepared with just the number of vacancies that there are ready to be elected that year. And the person who receives the slate has about four choices. He can write in a new name if he wants to. He can throw it away. He can vote for all or any of them. But whatever happens, the people on the slate are going to get elected. Well, that's not an election.
Well, the premise is that shareholders are as if they were citizens.
Yeah.
The board of directors is as if it were the
legislature.
The CEO is as if he were the chief executive or the president. And the bylaws are as if they were the Constitution. Bylaws and charter. Well, I've never seen it formulated as clearly as you did in Corpocracy in that way. And it belies really important truths.
Well, either somebody is very smart and is trying to use the legitimacy of our political vocabulary for power, or it just happened.
which could also be the case. Well, then you talk about shareholder
or
democracy.
Or it could be some judicious mixture of the two.
The idea of shareholder democracy, which is one that you champion, and I guess it's important to say you champion capitalism as a really important way to generate common good. So this is not a bashing of capitalism model of which you speak. When you talk about shareholder democracy within a capitalist system, that means something.
The important message about corporations is that they really are the best device that any society has ever concocted to create wealth. And then the real problem comes on the implications of gathering wealth, and to include in the language by which you account for that the various external impacts on society.
Externalities.
Externalities, as the economists would have it. And the difficulty is that there's a great resistance to trying to include those. So in effect, externalities are thrust onto the public. And the corporation doesn't have to be an evil creature. But the way in which the corporation now functions with its externalizing, it makes of every customer and every shareholder an enabler. Because when you buy something from a company that externalizes liabilities, you are making it possible for that company to be profitable and thereby enabling those activities which are contrary to the best interests of each of us and the society.
And wealth doesn't mean the CEO. When you say the generation of wealth, it has to do with the whole society, not just a handful of self-selected individuals.
The great dream for America is that through the pension systems, through the mutual funds, that the average American can get access to the wealth generation capability of large corporations. And it's quite simple, really. Over 200 years, the rate of return after inflation for debt securities is 2%. And the rate of growth for equity securities is 6%. And after 10 years, you're talking about a great, great difference. And it isn't just individuals who get this. It is, for example, when a city makes a commitment to its employees to pay them in a pension. Well, if they can only put invested money to work at 2%, it's going to be very, very difficult. They're going to have to raise taxes a great deal to be able to pay a meaningful pension. Whereas if they're able to invest this in common stocks, the 6% traditional rate of return makes it possible for society to take a much wider view. So it's wealth spread broadly.
I want to go back to the language, sort of, and specifically the science of economics.
The so-called science.
You point out something that I think most people don't know, and I forget a lot, which is that the Nobel Prize in economics, which we hear a great deal, and policies are endorsed because an economist who has won the Nobel Prize endorses this policy or this approach, whatever. And it isn't so. There is no effective Nobel Prize and no legitimate, right, depending on who you talk to, Nobel Prize. But the whole notion of the role of economics in providing the substrate for this corporatocracy, I think, is really important, and is not, I think most of us don't know about it, have not experienced or understood how this works.
Well, make sure that we say what the Bank of Sweden Prize is in memory of Nobel, that it's not the Nobel Prize, it's the Bank of Sweden Prize.
Right. Now, I have a friend, actually, who, at the same time, the Bank of Sweden offered the prize for economics. He offered one for environmentalism.
Oh, my.
And they turned him down.
Really?
His name is Jakob von Uxeld, and he runs a thing called the World Future Council. Mm-hmm. And he's a Swede. And, so there were people at work who thought that the patina, as it were, of the Nobel name would enhance the relative importance of economics. And that's really been wrong. Economics generates a number of worthwhile ideas, but they're not scientific. And they certainly don't deserve to be the sole discourse of public policy.
As they are now.
Yes. Stop and think for a minute about the last time somebody said to you as a governmental matter that they weren't going to do something because it was wrong. People will say they're not going to do it because it isn't cost effective.
Mm-hmm.
People talk about changing schools to make them work in a more business-like way. People talk about cost effectiveness of the delivery of medicine.
Efficiency, cost-benefit analysis.
Well, the cost-benefit analysis, now you do a nice job of putting that in context, in a historical context, and how that has diminished our understanding of economics specifically, but more generally, our understanding of living in a community.
And what matters in life.
That's the thing, is that as economics has about it a rather beguiling characteristic. And that is that if you just suspend disbelief for a while and assume that you can make a quantity or a number out of values, then you can put these into formulae and you can run them into computers and have high-speed printers, and out comes this enormous amount of material that must contain a good answer. Well, wrong, unfortunately. It contains a great deal of material. But the problem is that most important questions, indeed, from my way of thinking, all important questions, are not susceptible of being quantified.
Questions like?
Like, is it the right thing to do? Or, on balance, is it fair? Is it fair in our society to have the allocation of wealth that we have now?
And even more fundamentally, I mean, you know, economics touches people in various very specifically. It used to be political economics, mm-hmm. and then it got narrowed down, became a science, and then we lost the political piece. But finance would seem to lend itself to the you know, more technical, more numerical, and yet we've just gone through an experience with subprime loans, and I came across somebody with one of the, well, I think it was a hedge fund, who had said, you know, our models said that the probability of this happening was 10 to the minus 29th or something, which is a very small number. That is to say, it's essentially zero, that this could not happen, and yet it happened. Mm-hmm. And I say that because even in a narrower, more specific, numerically based discipline, finance, it is still not a science. There are a lot of assumptions, there are a lot of wishing and hoping, politics gets involved, and it's not surprising that something that is more general economics would not be reducible to numbers.
I'm going to interrupt so I don't have to do it again. It's also worth saying Adam Smith was a moral philosopher as well as, and moral philosophy was what he pursued as well as economics. This is Robert A.G. Monks with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. We'll all be back shortly. Please do stay with us. Welcome back. We are delighted to be with Robert H.G. Monks, whose book, Corpocracy, is a part of what we are prompted to talk about. We went away talking about Adam Smith, whose big ideas have had a lot of influence in the last couple hundred years, and it is for one very small part of his very large thinking that we remember him.
Well, I think Smith really had a holistic attitude. And he basically felt that economic activity had to take place within the framework of a society. In which the invisible hand allocated resources and accounted for a change, as it were. The problem is that as we moved through the Nobel process into the efforts of the economic community to claim impartiality because of its being neutral and being scientific, of course, all of these ambiguities had to be shaved off, and the result was that we end up with this very diminished language. Now, in the particular category that I'm terribly interested in, which relates to the importance of trust in American society, and the legal notion of trust is quite simply stated. It is, you appoint me trustee for Paula. I cannot take any step in my own interest that is contrary to Paula's interest. I owe Paula an absolutely overpowering obligation, uniquely and solely, to take care of her affairs when I accept that trust. Now, having said that, is being a trustee cost effective? It hasn't got anything to do with being cost effective. Well, what's happened is that throughout so many of the interstices of our social and political and economic system, trust is such a critical element. So the majority of shares of American companies are owned in trust for 100 million Americans. And yet, the notion of trust has been superseded by an economic notion. And there is a doctrine of law in economics, and there are courts who have said, in a sense, obey the law if it's cost effective.
That gets us into trouble.
Well, I think it has gotten us into trouble. I think that's one of the severe problems that we have. And my fantasy at the end of the book as to how you could actually do something about this has a hypothetical president of the United States. It could be this one if he'd like to do it. I read in the paper the other day that he's worried about CEO pay. But maybe he'll get to hear in 15 months. But my scene at the end is of the president calling in the people who are responsible for supervising the trustees. So the head of the SEC, the Assistant Secretary of Labor, the head of the Federal Reserve.
SEC being the Securities and Exchange
Commission, and that's for mutual funds, and Assistant Secretary of Labor for pension funds, and the Federal Reserve for bank trusts. And they're all federal, they're all existing laws, you don't need new laws. And in my fantasy, the president says to them, look, the law of this country is that your trustees, you own a controlling interest in the stock of these companies. If they aren't behaving well, it's your fault. And this administration believes that the involvement, informed involvement of owners is in the public good. And I have the Attorney General here just to remind you that this is going to be enforced as the law of the country.
So it's all there.
It's all there, and we have to take it back from where we've slid by having cost-effective economics dominate the very, very necessary soul of trust.
Oh. And then you have a second meeting with the Department of Defense.
Yeah, that's right.
And?
And the president and the head of the GAO.
Which is the government
Purchasing Office.
Which is to say that there is then this second function that our political entity could enforce for us. That is, the government of the United States is the biggest customer of anything in the world. And as a customer, back to those shareholders,
exactly,
we could have immense effect.
What it seems to me to be worth remembering, and it's a bit rude of me to say that about my own book, but what seems to me to be worthwhile is that you don't need any new laws. You don't need any new bureaucracies. You don't need any new taxes. You simply need to have purposeful direction from the executive branch of government that it is in the public good to have this notion of executive power and the CEO meaningfully accountable to the only element in the corporate constellation who's independent of him, which are the owners. And once you've said that, I think you may have a formula for a very healthy capitalist system.
I want to go back because it may not be obvious to people. You're talking about banks, you're talking about mutual funds, and you're talking about pension funds, all of which have these trustee responsibilities. You know what the number it is, I don't know, but that accounts for a tremendous amount of the investment in stocks and bonds and other types of investments in this country.
It's about two-thirds of the total of the public. The outstanding.
So this is, I mean, all that two-thirds is should be managed from a fiduciary perspective,
exactly,
with trust.
And with a long-term viewpoint, because take the pension system. If I'm going to be a good trustee for a pensioner who has 20 more years to work, I'm not doing the job if I just make him money. I have to run the trust property so that he retires into a clean world, into a law-abiding world, into a civil world. And so I have a fiduciary duty that you can describe quite accurately. And that you could use the word sustainable, that he has an obligation to manage the assets of the trust so that they are sustainable.
So what you're saying is, it goes beyond economics narrowly defined. It goes beyond economics even broadly defined. It becomes a matter of exercising that trust responsibility, that fiduciary responsibility, with respect to all the interests that those people have.
Exactly.
And essentially, there's a reasonableness test that should allow people who have this trust responsibility to be able to make those decisions?
I think the only limit on it would be that they can't be forced to do something that is uneconomical for the beneficiaries of the trust. You can't ask someone who owns 1% of the stock of a company to undertake the burden of putting up all the money to change the corporation for the benefit of everybody. You have to have a reasonableness test as to how much they could be asked to do within the scope of the size of their trust and what's in it.
And part of this, I want to go back. You're saying the laws are already there. Part of this is, with your attorney general at the table, is a matter of enforcing existing laws and regulations.
Yeah. Well, let me give you an example. We've had some very bad experiences lately. It's quite rare that you ever could point to a situation and say, the failure of that trustee to vote actually means something, as most votes aren't that close and there aren't that many recorded votes. Well, about 5 years ago, we had the merger of Hewlett-Packard and Compaq. And there, it was down to the last minute. And the SEC ultimately brought an enforcement action that alleged that the management of Hewlett-Packard paid a fee to a trustee for the success of the merger. And they found out that this same trustee, the Deutsche Bank, in a different branch, was voting their stock against the merger. And there was a phone call the day of the vote. And the Deutsche Bank flipped its vote. And that appears to be the margin by which the merger was approved. Now, here was a case, and I've asked the General Accountability Office to investigate why the Department of Labor hasn't investigated it, which they haven't. There's no answer. Their comment is we don't comment on things that are under investigation. And so
Joseph Heller's alive and well.
So you have a terrible problem here, that if you have a government that is determined not to enforce the law, you can ultimately destroy the meaning of trust.
And then there's the added problem, if you will, here, that when that government says we're going to rely on self-monitoring, self-censorship, that those people in business will watch their own behaviors and will adjust them appropriately, that's sort of the fox in the hen house problem, isn't it?
It just summons to memory a wonderful image of Eliot Spitzer, now governor of New York, appearing before the Senate Banking Committee and saying self-regulation doesn't work in the financial business, period. And you have to say that he had a fair amount of experience in that area.
This is Robert A.G. Monks. The three of us will be back shortly. We hope that you will make it four. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. It is our great pleasure and privilege to be with Robert A.G. Monks. We're talking about corpocracy, the concept, having been privileged to read the book where you codify many of these things. Bill Russell and I both thoroughly enjoyed reading it. I actually thought it was quite a page-turner because it is relevant, it is important, it speaks to lots of things that are fundamental to who and what we are, both personally and as a society. And then there is this time and time again, I'd say page-turner, I think, but in America, the idea that the individual has property rights and owns things, and that is, can I say, sacred in America, and yet the idea of personal property rights goes away when you're talking about corpocracy versus a democracy.
You know, this is, I hope I'm given the gift of clarity in language, but when you talk about property, you're clearly talking about something quite different between owning a horse and owning a share of stock. And part of the genius of the corporate scheme is that the owner of a piece of stock has limited liability. His liability is limited to what his investment is.
Which is a good thing.
It's a good thing, except when you go to him and you say, you as a shareholder ought to do the right thing. He looks at you and says, I've just talked to my lawyer and he tells me I don't have to do anything. You know, I have limited liability. Now, about 20 years ago, the penny dropped for me, and I discovered that a majority of the shareholders of American companies were trustees. And they can't just do nothing. They are obligated to take action in order to protect and enhance the trust property.
Legally obligated.
Legally obligated. And so therefore, you now can talk about at least the trustee owners must take appropriate action to enhance the value of the trust estate.
It's also worth saying that this limited liability is part of the deal that allows a corporation to exist.
Absolutely.
And we forget that is the case, that there's a trade-off here.
So it's hard, you know, conceptually, to begin talking about responsibility, because the essence of the arrangement is that their responsibility is limited to their investment. So what we're introducing here by virtue of the emergence of the trustee as the majority owner is the beginning of an ethical ownership culture based on trust law. And so it's a way in which you can go beyond the limitations that you'd have if you had only individual owners.
Let me step way back. When I got through reading your book, two things jumped out at me as central, and then all the flesh that goes around that, and as well as the recommendations, which are obviously very important. One is that there is a problem of in the context you're talking about kleptocracy,
mm-hmm.
As in kleptomania.
That people, because they have essentially unchecked power. Specifically, chief executives, basically chief executive, and that's who you pinpoint. That they are enriching themselves, their enrichment is coming out of the owner's pocket. You know, that's the first issue, which is really a question of legitimacy, a question of fairness, a question of justice. And we have laws, nominally, as you pointed out. The other issue is a longer term, and you've already referred to that, which is that ultimately this won't work. That it's throwing sand in the gears of a really neat system.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me both of those are very important. Mm-hmm. The first in terms of our relationship to the body politic of which we're a part and of which corporations are a very important
right.
part. And the other, of course, is our long-term economic, broadly speaking, economic well-being as a nation and as individuals.
And the world.
And to a lesser extent, we're in less control of the world than we think we are, but to a lesser extent, the entire world.
Well, you know, when you raise the question of the world, it's another context, because historically, people have thought that the accountability of corporations was to the place where they live, to their domicile, the place that gave them their charter. And now you have a phenomenon like, take ExxonMobil.
Of which you are an owner.
An American company. Only 30% of ExxonMobil's earnings come from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to the place now where there's an asymmetry between the political source of power, which is the country, and the corporate source of power, which is the world. And so there's going to be the need to have institutions created that can function across countries on a global basis. And the fascinating balance here is that we've also had the emergence of the institutional investors who own stock all over the world. And so, in effect, the only pieces of the puzzle that are global, genuinely, are the owners and the managers.
You used the magic word balance. There is inherent balance available within the corporate structure as well as within the political structure. And when we get out of balance is when we get into big trouble.
That's the sand in the gears.
Well, I think the sand in the gears, no less an authority than the President of the United States this week, and this being Second week of October of 2007, the president is appalled, which is an interesting word for him to use, by the level of CEO pay, and he exhorts shareholders to take action. It's a fine sentiment, and I wish it were self-executing, but it is evidence of how serious the problem is and how much sand there is in the gears when someone who has been very much identified with sort of the business roundtable America, all its administration, should come out and say something like that about the members of the business roundtable.
You'd point out a statistic that I to me was crystallized in some ways what you're talking about, that over, I think it was in the 90s and the early 2000s, that something like 10% of the profits of American corporation had been transferred from, not to the owners, but to essentially to the chief executive officers.
Right.
And it is a staggeringly large number. I think it's in the order of
$1 trillion.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, yeah. Now, having said that, I mean, my first reaction is that's an outrage. My second reaction is that's an outrage. My third reaction is it's an outrage. My fourth reaction, though, is to try to see why this should even be possible. And that the argument, and I think this, you must encounter this all the time, is that the shareholders are making so much money out of the stock market, and this goes to the sand in the gears piece, I think, that they're making so much money that if, 10%, essentially the skim off the top, the VIG, as you call it, vigorish, is okay because we get the other 90% and it's a great big pie, so, what's to worry about?
Well, I think I have one chart in the book, which I rather like, and let's start in 1992. And I start in 1992 because that's the year a wonderful book was written by a man named Bud Crystal called In Search of Excess. And it was all about Bud. Bud was a reformed compensation consultant.
Recovering?
Recovering.
Detoxing?
Just excellent. And he analyzes the situation in 1992 as being very bad. So we start the chart then. And we move in lines and show the cost of living, we show the rise of the stock market, and we show the rise of CEO pay. Well, the rise of CEO pay is 225% of what the rise of the stock market is. I mean, it's just way out of sight. It is no correlation to it at all. And the difficulty has been that there has been no effort by anybody that has stopped this trend.
Although a couple of people have personally been able to say, that ain't right.
Well, there are some corporate leaders who have been absolutely splendid. I mean, I'm out of GE, you just have to say, is the nearest thing to a corporate statesman on the subject. And then Frank Blake taking over Home Depot. Just changed the ratio. It used to be you got 90% for showing up to work and the other 10% if you did anything for the shareholders. Now we only just 10% for showing up to work. And in a lousy housing market, Frank's got to struggle for his other 90.
But the outrages, as you say, is when CEOs are getting these staggering amounts of money and losing money for the shareholders. That's the other side of that equation. They're getting compensated.
You point to Pfizer, and until you pulled it all together in one place, I was not clear what had gone on with Pfizer. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I'm sure that's why you included it. It brings all the cast together.
Yeah.
In a very not pretty way. Can you do a capsule version of
well, the,
that?
The really ugly part about it, and Pfizer has had a really good board of directors. I mean, they're good people. They do good things. Indeed, they forced Mr. McKinnell to retire. And they've gone on a number of other advances. So it's an interesting case because you had a good board. But the pattern, genuinely upsetting, just to have a fifth emphasis on your own adjective, because the pattern has become one that the preponderance of compensation is focused now in areas where you weren't previously legally obligated to report. So in the case of Mr. McKinnell at Pfizer, where he was getting it was through a pension system, which the extent of which wasn't publicly disclosed until a couple of years before he quit.
The irony in that is...
yeah, that's right. He got a fast retirement.
Out of a pension system.
And I don't know whether, you know, words are not self-executing. They're always very clever people who can find ways of making something legal when it isn't the intent of the people who wrote the law. But hopefully the new disclosure requirements that have been put into effect in the last year or two will at least enable shareholders to know what people are being paid. But the Pfizer case was an example of where the stealth compensation came in, which makes the level of pay even more egregious.
It also brings in the business roundtable. We really haven't talked about the business roundtable, and that seems to be a key piece of this.
Let's do that when we come back. And just as a summation on the Pfizer, $254 million is the number I remember as compensation, having lost 40% of the share value for the stockholders at the time of his exit. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back in a moment. More on the business roundtable with Robert A.G. Monks. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I, Paula, are delighted to be with Robert A.G. Monks. I was out of the country not very long ago with a group of women from all over the world who, once they got comfortable with the fact that I wasn't going to defend America's current policies, were willing to be quite candid, and they said, "What has happened to America? Something has changed from the America we thought we knew." And in fact, some things have changed. You start in 1971 with Supreme Court Justice Powell was, by a couple months, was a Supreme Court Justice. You talk about specific things that have happened, including the Business Roundtable. So the question of what happened to America has some predicates. You want to start with the Business Roundtable?
Well, yes, the Business Roundtable was something that was very much needed in America, as business interests had been incredibly poorly represented for many years, and there was a very bad imbalance as the legitimate interest of our society to have a healthy business was being impeded by the incompetence of the business group. And John Connally, the former governor of Texas, at least by rumor, is reported to have going up to Washington and explained to the people how to do it. And they put together about 73, 74, this business roundtable that was to be just chief executives and very, very tightly run by an executive committee, only a couple of hundred of them. They couldn't send delegates to meetings. They had to go themselves. They didn't have much of a staff at the business roundtable, so they used the corporate staffs, which of course were excellent people. And the executive committee gave them projects to do. Well, what became clear to me one day is I started a company called ISS, Institutional Shareholder Services, about 20 years ago. And a couple of iterations later, when my son was the chairman of it and I was no longer involved, the CEO of the company was a man named John Connally, and he was sitting in his office, and he was visited by the John Castellani, who is the executive running the business roundtable, who proceeded to berate him about a recommendation that ISS made about the pay of Henry McKinnell of Pfizer.
Back to Pfizer.
Well, it turned out that Henry McKinnell wasn't only the CEO of Pfizer, he was the head of the Business Roundtable. And so the idea that the Business Roundtable was using its executives' time and energy to promote the personal interest of individual CEOs made me think again and say, look, how can you explain this statistical discrepancy where there's no correlation between CEO pay and any kind of addition of value to anybody? It didn't just happen. When I remembered my childhood, and I remembered Sherlock Holmes, you know, and when every other possibility doesn't explain it, well, you'd have to say that at some point, quite clearly, there was a level of agreement among these people. And that with that level of agreement, and there are several very good articles in the New York Times talking about top people in the business roundtable meeting and putting pressure on accountants about their attitude about stock options. And these are consistent with a theory that the business roundtable was the sort of vehicle through which meeting CEOs were able to fix the price of chief executive compensation.
You talk about fixing, you talk about gaming the system, you talk about the stock market becoming a grand casino, you talk about cheating. These are not typically core American values. So that's part of what's happening here, isn't it?
I think that there was such success in an escalation of CEO pay, where people always thought CEOs would be rich, but they didn't necessarily think that they all had to be in the same position as someone who'd founded the company and who'd been at an equity risk all that time. This changed over that period of time.
And they are managers.
And they're managers. And so the nature of the job was redefined, and they became partners.
There's the illusion of objectivity because these people hire compensation consultants who come in and do analysis and objectively evaluate what the going rate in the market is and say that you're worth $250 million because that's what the going rate is. I don't remember the exact word that you used to describe that, but it's something in the range of poppycock.
Or hogwash, or one of those.
Well, you know, there's a wonderful example. I don't have it in the book, but the compensation of the chief executive of Fannie Mae has been very sharply questioned. And there is a regulatory agency called OFHEO, which is set up by Congress simply to audit Fannie Mae. And they did an investigation that revealed a discussion in which an executive of Fannie Mae is suggesting people who could be advisors to the audit to the compensation committee. And the person to whom they make the suggestion comes back to them and says, I've just gone to the boss, and he doesn't want to have Snodgrass on that because he doesn't think his attitude is right. Well, there it is. It's there for you, that the whole process is one that is dominated by the CEO. And he picks the consultants, he picks the people on the committee, and so the independence is simply a ghastly distortion of a word that otherwise is a very reputable one.
You used early on the word power. Money, second only to brute force, money in the world we live in, capital more generally, is a tremendous source of power. It provides personal power, it provides power to a corporation. A corporation that has accreted large sums of money, mm-hmm. Or even has, you know, controls the flow of it, mm-hmm. Has tremendous power. And that power can be exercised for good. It can be exercised solely for the benefit of the corporation, or it can be used to do some not very good things. And part of the story you're telling seems to be that some of that is the latter case. Not the least of which is chief executives who, because they have the power and the control, are enriching themselves at the expense of their stockholders.
Well, that's the smoking gun. And, you know, if I always say to myself, as I've spent a great deal of energy over the last 20 years trying to improve corporate governance, and I must say I haven't been very successful. And the evidence of not being successful is that if you can't stop someone from paying themselves whatever they want to, you really can't deduce that you really have any impact at all, because
but they are essentially, as you describe it, and it seems to be accurate. They are essentially no checks on their power.
No effective checks.
No effective checks.
Yeah, there's lots of nominal. I mean, there are committee structures that have kept legions of lawyers employed for years. But as a practical matter, the power is in the CEO. He uses the power, he dominates the committee structure, he dominates the hiring of consultants. And I've occasionally persuaded people to speak up, and I have to tell you, it's like trying to get people to volunteer for kamikaze missions.
You talk about
as rewarding.
Yeah, and about as rewarding.
You talk about process, and you say, you know, that sounds like a boring word. You also talk about governance, and quite to the contrary, this isn't boring. Mm. This is the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. This is at the heart of who we are, how we are, what we're going to allow among and between people. This is the political economy. So governance, of which you have, to which you've given so much attention, of which you've been a part. And again, it's, I think, important to say that you're not talking as an outsider, you're talking as an insider from all kinds of insider perspectives. The way we govern and are governed is central to how we do or do not have a functioning society.
Absolutely. And I think the word corporocracy means the corporation and its interests taking over the political system. And you begin to think of, I don't know when the history of this time is written, what will be said about the privatization of the military functions in the Iraq War. But clearly the agenda is very much influenced by the possibility of profit for private companies. And exactly how profound is that, and what's the chicken and what's the egg? At some point we're going to find out. We don't know, but we certainly have a lot of evidence that the role of the corporations as providers of legal violence, legal in quotes, has been critical to the United States' capacity to stay there. The president has said so himself. And what I think of myself, you were talking, Paul, about how we're a different country. I think of myself, and I have three draft-age grandchildren. And if we had a draft, and if our involvement in Iraq required a political consensus adequate to support a draft, would I be doing the same things I'm doing today about Iraq? I would not. I would be lying down on Pennsylvania Avenue, kicking and screaming. And I'm not doing any of that. Well, my diminished citizenship, of which I'm ashamed, probably is representative of other people. And in effect, this is one more thing that we've corporatized. We've corporatized the use of violence. It used to be you could only use violence when you got political consent to do it.
I grew up at a time when the Hessians were reviled. The Hessians fought for the British in the Revolutionary War.
And as mercenaries.
They were reviled because they were mercenaries. They weren't fighting for principle. They weren't fighting for their country. They weren't fighting for the good against evil. They were fighting for money. And that's just gone away.
I tell you what comes around goes around. We're the mercenaries. We're the Hessians today.
And you talk about arrogance in that context. And arrogance as part of this equation is very important.
Yes, it is.
Pride cometh before the fall.
Yes. I have to say that whenever I say that, and then I say, well, God, I hope it doesn't take the whole country with it. At the same time, I hope you're right. I hope that this arrogance doesn't go unrequited.
We'll be back in just a moment for a few more minutes with Robert A.G. Monks. Be with us when we return. We're back for a couple more minutes with Robert A.G. Monks, Bill Russell, and I, Paula Gordon. The many things that you have done include shareholder activism, which is, to me, one of the many good news parts of your book, Corporocracy, is there are things we can do.
Well, the it's quite disappointing. Just this last month, I received an opinion from the Federal District Court in Massachusetts that said, I am not eligible to be a plaintiff in a class action lawsuit because I'm an activist. Now, that's really the last straw because as a shareholder, you have virtually no rights in America compared to, say, England, where you have rights to get rid of directors. You can't do that in this country. The essential tragedy is that the only people who are activists are inclined to be union funds and public funds. And this invites the characterization that they have a anti-capitalist, left-wing agenda and diminishes their credibility, and very unfairly. Now, the reason this exists is because the other funds choose not to be involved.
So tragedy can turn into opportunity.
And they continue to choose. I mean, Harvard University, I've been corresponding with for 30 years on the subject. And Harvard is a very aggressive manager of their money, but they find that this would, becoming activist, would somehow compromise their mission, or it might make some potential donors nervous. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has said exactly the same thing, that they want to get about giving away their money. They don't want to worry about these companies in which they're invested. And until and unless we get the full spectrum of ownership, the owner agenda will necessarily be suspect, and the utility of involved ownership as the mechanism to produce a holistic capitalism will not be realized.
Well, sitting listening to you talking about the court case, it's not a fair representation, but it's not also wrong, I think. Corporations, with Lewis Powell's help, have First Amendment rights. They've got free speech. They get to speak. Mm-hmm. You don't. Now, it's in a specific set of circumstances in a court, but those kinds of decisions have been out there. So we have legitimate, real human beings, real people, mm-hmm. whose First Amendment rights are being abridged, where we have ersatz people, corporations, whose First Amendment rights are being expressed all day, every day, with this large power source, which is their economic clout.
Yeah. It's changed the nature of our society. And one of the things, that just getting back to where we started, is about language, is that the dialogue now is disproportionately the dialogue of business. And the example of that would be in a Democratic administration, the dialogue about globalization. The dialogue about globalization was, well, if we export jobs, in the long run, it makes more wealth for more people. Fine. But did anybody take the time to say, in the short run, what do you do about the people who are really getting hurt by this? And if you come to my home state of Maine and you go to, say, Dexter, Maine, a flourishing home of a wonderful company, Dexter Shoe Company, now part of Warren Buffett's holdings, factory shut, not a job there. Wonderful managers, but they couldn't deal with the disparity of pay. Now, no one has done anything for the people who lived in Dexter, Maine. And so we had a very narrow definition of economic self-interest has driven this.
There's this wonderful phrase that I had forgotten if I knew it, that is that we must be in the business not of short-term greed, of long-term greed, yeah. Except that the human animal is greedy and be looking at a long-term so as to profit everyone.
Yes, I think that, and that's a matter of language. And I think there isn't anybody in America who doesn't want a clean country and a clean world and a civil world.
And by virtue of the work you are doing, we can do that.
Well, I have to demur. I've had quite a bit of disappointment in this. I think the theory of it is right, but I can't point to very much in the way of positive consequence.
Tell me what I can do. Don't tell me what you fail to do. Tell me what I can do.
What you can do very simply is to go to the university that you attended, to go to any organizations, churches of which you're a member, find out about their endowment, find out who runs their endowment, and you make a personal commitment to talk to the people who are running the money for that institution. Because none of the people in this are bad people. The people who run corporations are not bad people. It is just that absent rules, they make up rules that are most in their self-interest. But it's up to us to get those rules, and you can get it if you start to convince the trustees that they must be responsive to their beneficiaries.
And I can do that in a democracy.
You can do it right now. You can do it. The mind boggles, but there are probably 4 or 5 groups that everybody watching this, is associated with. They can go and say, why aren't you doing something about this? Do something about this. Here are problems that you can do something about. And it's a matter of everybody just taking it on themselves to do this.
Change happens one person at a time.
At a time.
We believe corporatocracy is something we all need to know about if democracy and capitalism are to flourish, and we strongly recommend the book itself. We're immensely grateful to Mr. Monks for writing it, and we thank him also for sharing his experience and insights with us here. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.